Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Dr. Sharif Akili, resident physician at Stanford Hospital and investor at Polaris Partners. Join Sharif in exploring the extraclinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is the former CEO of the Kaiser Permanente Medical Group, Dr. Robert Pearl. Welcome to the first episode of the summer interseason. We have an incredible guest I'm excited to introduce the audience to, Dr. Robert Pearl. Robert is probably best known for being the CEO of the Kaiser Permanente Medical Group for 18 years between 1999 to 2017 at a very pivotal time for the nation's largest medical group. But many may not know he's also a professor of plastic surgery at the Stanford School of Medicine. He's on faculty at the Stanford Graduate School of Business as well, where he teaches courses on strategy and leadership, which I can attest from colleagues is absolutely fantastic. And if that's not enough, Robert is a regular contributor to Forbes, and he's a prolific writer. Most recently, he's authored an exceptional deep dive into physician culture in the book, Uncaring, How the Culture of Medicine Kills Doctors and Patients, which I just finished reading. It came out just a few weeks ago. I cannot recommend this book more highly, and all the profits and proceeds of the book go to Doctors Without Borders. Robert, thanks so much for taking the time to be here with me today. What an honor.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for hosting the video and podcast.
Of course, of course. So I have so many questions, and I want to save some time to talk about your book too, because I can't stop thinking about some of the stories you shared in there. But before I do, I want to ask a little bit about your background. Can you share a little bit for the audience how a plastic surgeon goes from a rigorous, one you would expect, all-consuming surgical subspecialty to ultimately running Kaiser Permanente and 10,000 physicians and being such an important voice in medicine?
Since I know that much of your audience are people in the early parts of their careers, let me start back in college. Now, I was 17 years old, I went to college, I wanted to be a university professor. And in my first year, my hero, a professor who would go on to become chairman at Reed, didn't get tenure because of his political views. And I decided I wanted to go into something that would have no politics, and that would be medicine. I was still a teenager. But it seemed to me it was life and death. It should not be political. And so I left college after 3 years, went to Yale Medical School, and decided to come to Stanford to become a heart surgeon. And there I experienced politics again, because the best surgeons weren't getting the referrals. It was often the people who were at the right country clubs, had the right family connections. And I became disillusioned a second time. And at that point, I went to Mexico as part of a volunteer team to fix children with cleft lip and cleft palate, which is how I became a plastic surgeon, which is what I specialized in, reconstructive surgery for kids.
And then my residency.
What's that?
Do you still practice, Robert?
At this point, I stopped after my book was published because it was not possible to operate on Monday, go speak somewhere else in the United States, and have a complication on Tuesday or Wednesday. So I had to make the difficult decision. But you're getting a little ahead of the story because—
Sorry, yeah, please go on.
Well, because this is all about how serendipity is so powerful. At the end of my residency, I was going to South America to fix kids with cleft lip and cleft palate. And the plastic surgeon died in a tragic plane crash at Santa Clara Kaiser. I'd never heard of Kaiser in my life. And they called me up and said, would you come for a few months till we find someone else? And I said, what can you lose for a few months? And again, just happenstance, but I loved the environment when I got there. And so one of the lessons I'm going to tell people listening in is that windows open and windows close. You may be prepared to jump whenever they open, or you'll find yourself unable to do so later on. But to get to the question you posed about leadership, my first year there, I got approached by the head of the medical staff. And he asked me whether I'd become chairman of the operating room committee. Now, the operating room was in big trouble at the time. It was a nursing shortage period. They were having to close rooms and cancel surgery. And I was sure that he had come to me because I was so smart, my credentials were so good. No, he came to me because everyone else said no. I was like the last one on the block and foolish enough to not recognize what doing so would mean. But again, I enjoyed the experience. And in Kaiser Permanente, you get progressive leadership ability. I was appointed the assistant physician chief at Santa Clara, which is the largest of the medical centers in Kaiser Permanente. When I was there, actually only for 2 years, I wasn't yet what's called the senior shareholder. I got the opportunity to go to Stanford Business School. And by the time the 2019 came, or sorry, 1999 came around, there I was with a pretty large responsibility running Santa Clara as I took on progressive accountability. But the CEO stepped down. And he stepped down because Kaiser Permanente was in big trouble. The organization was down to 2 days of cash, had to borrow a day of money in order to meet the state regulatory requirements. And again, it was not a job that I was seeking inside Kaiser Permanente, inside the medical group. The decision is made by physicians about who will lead them. I asked several people who I thought could do a really great job. If they would step forward, I'd be happy to help them in any way possible. And they all said, are you out of your mind? That's a terrible job. It's almost impossible. And I decided at that point that if I didn't step forward, whoever stepped forward is not someone I'd want to follow. So it was a series of twists and turns, but it was a great decision. You know, I often say that in my life I've had, or my professional life, I had three careers. I was a surgeon taking care of, let's say, maybe 10,000 people. And then I was the CEO responsible for maybe 10 million. And my hope right now in writing this book, my first book was Mistreated, a Washington Post bestseller, and now on Caring, that I'll be able to move the healthcare forward and improve the health of 330 million Americans.
Wow. Reflecting on people's careers, there's often this idea that we each have a superpower that help us achieve our goals. What do you think might have been your superpower going through each of those phases?
I have a belief unsubstantiated by any research. I want to be clear, people are knowledgeable about this. And that is that we are all born with a certain set of ability, whether it's how fast we can run, how high we can jump, how good looking we are, how well we can solve math problems, how well we can write, and that we have this ability to move three steps up on a 1 to 10 scale. And one of the great gifts that God gave me is that in a lot of areas, I'm a one. You don't want to hear me sing as an example. You know, I can spend my entire life, 10,000 hours, as Malcolm Gladwell says, trying to master singing, and maybe I could get to a four. So to the point you're making, yeah, I would say that there are things that luckily I could do well. And one of them is this notion of strategic thinking. And strategic thinking, when I teach in the business school, is this ability to see into the future and be able to see what is coming before it arrives and to do an internal calculation of statistically or probabilistically, what are the actions you can take to maximize your likelihood of success. And that's something that I've been able to do. And in many ways, as I said earlier about the windows opening, I could jump through the windows because I could see the chances were on the other side that they were good. You have to have the courage to do so because who knows, maybe there was nothing else, no ledge on the other side of that window and you'd fall on down to the ground. But that's what I would say. It's this ability to see what was coming. And I could see the changes happening in medicine when I became the CEO. There was a sign in the Oregon Health Services building that I saw early in my career. It said across the top, quality, service, and cost. And along the bottom, it said, pick any two. That was the mentality of the 20th century. But I can see that in the 21st century, you'd have to be able to do all three. And it could get done if you could restructure how you did the delivery of care, to integrate that care, to work in collaborative and coordinated ways. New technology You know, we invested in the electronic health record soon after the turn of the century, long before anyone else, at a cost of $1 billion to implement it. And it allowed us to move from being a good organization, somewhere in the middle of the pack on quality, to number one of 1,000 organizations when it came to the NCQA. I could see the evolution of a consumer-oriented world and the need to be able to provide care with easier and more rapid access. And we were able to move from what's a typical 14-day type delay for specialty consultation down to 40% the same day and 60 or 70% within 2 to 3 days, something that most people thought impossible, and to apply telemedicine as a major tool of doing so. I wrote an article in Health Affairs about 7 years ago where I noted the fact that we were already doing 14 million virtual visits while the rest of the world was probably altogether not doing quite that number. And at the time I said that telemedicine would replace 30% of what we do in the office. And what happened? Nothing. Little changed in healthcare for about 6 years. And then COVID comes along and all of a sudden many doctors are doing 60 to 70% by telemedicine. The technology didn't change. Yeah, a few of the regulations and some of the Medicare reimbursement did shift, but all of a sudden the world was ready to embrace a technology. I'd say these are the kinds of things that I was fortunate enough to have the ability around, but there's a long list of things for which I would say that I'm right near the bottom when it comes to people's skills and natural abilities.
Robert, when do you think you recognized this talent for strategic thinking? Did you realize you had this passion back in medical school or when you were 17 years old or even residency?
No, I think in my medical school and residency, what I wanted to be was a great physician. Mm-hmm. And I worked hard. Yale's interesting. It has no grades, no exams. And yet my observation is people work just as hard or harder there to learn the material and to move forward. I was a really hardworking resident at Stanford. I do write in the book about a time when I was up for 3 consecutive nights and my patient sent me home because I looked sicker than he did. But so maybe I went a bit too far. But I think I embraced all the parts to be the best physician that I could be. And I never really saw myself wanting to move into this leadership role until that opening that I mentioned about chairman of the operating room committee. And so here was a conundrum that people faced where there just were not enough people. And the solution was cancel ORs, delay care. And I said, no, there's gotta be other opportunities. And so the idea of bringing in flying nurses from agencies that didn't yet exist. I mean, it's common right now, but way back then it was pretty rare. And we were able to find some that could come in on a contract basis. And we offered training to the nurses in the who were already in the OR and in the critical care units to become OR nurses and gave them 6 months of training to elevate their skill. And we found other nurses who weren't yet having that advanced skill and gave them a year of training. And by a year, year and a half later, we had solved the difficulty. And I think that's what got me noticed, that ability to see into the future, to develop a plan, and then to be able to both align and motivate people around it in a way to achieve success.
And you had done, you were at the GSB before then, is that right?
No, it was after that. Once I became the assistant physician in chief, Kaiser sends its people to a variety of programs at Stanford. Actually, now they send them to variety of programs at Harvard to be able to get more executive training and more expansive training.
What do you think about that path toward getting executive training compared to more traditional paths or doing it earlier in your career?
An article I wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine really close to a decade ago is why every fourth year medical student should spend a month in the Graduate School of Business. To learn how to put teams together, to learn how to motivate, to learn how to lead, to apply technology sitting in play. Now, again, the idea was at the time based upon the fact that in fourth year of medical school, you waste a lot of your year simply traveling around with various interviews for residency positions. I wasn't smart enough back at the time to point out that it could be done virtually. But as you know, that's exactly what happened last year. And think about that. We probably waste 6 or 9 months of a crucial time in training to accomplish that, and how much more could be done. There's a lot of other ways that time could be applied, but this opportunity to gain those skills for a month or even a bit longer than that and learn how to apply them. How do you make care more efficient? As an example, a patient admitted to a hospital on Friday night spends an extra day with the exact same diagnosis as the patient admitted on Monday night. Now that's worse quality. Something can go wrong. A hospital-acquired infection, a medical error, right? Bad service, not convenient, higher cost, but we keep doing that. And how do we think about the change? And this will take us a little bit maybe into the book on caring, how the culture of medicine kills doctors and patients. There's a symbol for the medical profession, the caduceus. This is two snakes that wind around a staff, and it's often seen on the uniforms of various doctors and in medical textbooks. And I see those two snakes as being the system of medicine and the culture of medicine. And they're intimately entwined. How we reimburse doctors, how healthcare is structured, how we approach technology, how we think about equity, how we look at social determinants of health. These are all systemic issues. And yet at the same time, every one of them has a cultural bearing. Sometimes it provides us the courage, as it did during the early part of the coronavirus, to take care of patients 12 and 24 hours a day, you know, donning garbage bags when there are no longer any gowns, salad lids when there are no masks. But other times it leads us to inflict harm, both on patients and on ourselves. I think the inability to deny our emotion. I mean, as a resident, what are you taught? You know, never stay home, never admit your pain, never say you need help. The idea of getting psychological assistance is beyond something that is tolerated inside that culture. And yet, what we know is that COVID-19 inflicted major harm. I talked to a physician who lost 4 patients in one day. Imagine that. I mean, the pain that he must have felt. I write in the book about losing one patient, a patient who had leukemia, who ultimately died from infection, and how difficult it was to go to sleep that night, and how I needed to repression and denial to wake up the next morning so I could put my full attention on the little girl who needed her cleft lip repaired. But imagine when it's so great, you can't do that. And yet you still try to cram it in, the harm inflicted upon doctors. And from a patient standpoint, I mean, we can talk about issues around chronic disease that were poorly controlled. We can talk about discrimination that happened to people of color. We can talk about the inability to provide the technological services that could improve care. We can go through any of those pieces that you want to go through in our time today.
Yeah, there's so much to piece out there. In fact, one of the things, circle back a little bit, because there isn't much writing out there on the culture of medicine. And your book is incredibly thorough in showing both the beauty and the dark underbelly of medicine in ways that just made me, every time I was reading it, I was just like, yes. And you almost having that self-awareness a little bit. And one of the curiosities I had, because there wasn't as much a mention of this in the book, was, did you feel, you know, you were talking about how it might be beneficial for, and you had written about this, that every medical student spend 1 month in business school, their fourth year of medical school. Do you think there are any lessons for medicine culture from business culture and vice versa? Because one of the greatest, I feel like, eye-opening events for me was to go to business school and see how different just the way the hierarchy and the way people interacted was so incredibly different in business than medicine. As somebody who has really been in both worlds, have you discovered or encountered any lessons that each piece might be able to learn from the other in a way that might be beneficial for both parties and for patients ultimately?
Oh, certainly. There are so many opportunities to learn, but before I mention a couple of them,
sure.
I do want to point out one of the important barriers, which is that failure in business, particularly in Silicon Valley, is a badge of courage. Or if you haven't had a couple of new entities on entrepreneurial forays fail, it means you haven't really had much experience. You're not very good. You're expected to fail looking for the 1 in 100 opportunity to succeed. Medicine, you can't. Failure is really problematic, particularly if somehow you're responsible for it. It's someone else's life, not just simply an economic consequence or something to yourself. So we have to recognize that existing. But I would say at least 2 or 3 different opportunities. Number one is, how do you make more efficient systems? And we don't question what we do. So an example of something that could be done that we did in Kaiser Permanente was when a patient was coming in to see a primary care physician and that physician needed a referral. What's the traditional way? You send something to the specialty department. They book an appointment a few days later, maybe a few weeks later, depending upon what the backlog looks like. And we think that's great medical care. But what we don't realize is how often what is needed is not a consultation. It's a small piece of expertise. And the idea of asking, how do you bring that into the exam room? And so we did that with video. Dermatology is a great example. This is when the primary care physician saw a patient with a rash that the doctor felt he or she needed to have specialty help. Not the ones the primary care physician took care of. That's a lot of them. But the ones that he or she could not take care of. And using a digital photograph, 70% of the time, we could make the right diagnosis and then begin treatment the same day. I mean, think about how much better that is. The diagnosis is made the same day. The treatment is started the same day. It doesn't require missing another day of work or school. Relief is provided immediately. The cost is much lower. And yet in the culture of medicine, we don't think about those things, some of which because there's no business school background, and some of which because what do we value? Our offices. And our offices are places where we are at the top of the hierarchy. In fact, what do we call the area just beyond the door to the office? It's called a waiting room. The job of the patient is to wait, which really leads to the second one, which is moving from, I'll call it a paternalistic concept of the 20th century into a customer-focused one. Now, again, as doctors, we hate the idea of thinking about our patients as consumers or in some other way, customers. But I think there's a lot of fulfillment that comes from pleasing people. And we please them with the expertise we provide, the treatment we offer. We also do it when we show our empathy and our sympathy. We respect their time and their convenience. Now, before I say very much more, a lot of listeners will say, but we don't get paid for that. The insurance companies are a problem. We see too many patients a day. Patients are too demanding. And that's all right. That's all correct. But it doesn't mean that because we are not able to respond to it, that it actually benefits us. And so that opportunity to be able to focus more on it. And I think more significantly than all of that, it's really moving from a fee-for-service type reimbursement model to a capitated one. I speak to a lot of business CEOs, and I always ask them, how many of you have remodeled your kitchen or your bathroom? Just about every hand goes up. And then I say, how many of you said to the contractor, you do whatever you think best, I'll just pay it time and materials? All the hands come down. Now, why is that? Because what they recognize is that when you create incentives, and business school talks a lot about incentives, you realize that it has predictable consequences, not random ones. And people are likely to do more, to make it ever more complex. And I will say to take risks, because they're not at risk. It is you, the owner, or the payer who's at risk. And I think that's where the healthcare system is today. So there's a lot of principles we could apply if in the culture of medicine, we saw our job as making care more affordable. We saw our job as making care more equitable, but we don't define that as our job. We really see our job as starting by whoever comes through our front door as though that's a random process, and doing the best that we can for that individual. And we work really hard and we do a great job. I don't want to take anything away, but what a business school background would give is I'd call it a broader view of what's going on and identify opportunities to do better and to use technology. I mean, I'll give you an example that you're well aware of. Try to think of another industry besides medicine in which the introduction of technology has raised costs, not lower them. Manufacturing? No. You know, travel? No. Retail? No. The only industry that I can think of where investments in technology have raised cost is healthcare, and most of them have yet to show significant quality improvements. Another piece in every other industry. You know, if you have any doubt about all of that, you can just look at how we lag other countries, despite our added investments in things like capital in the United States, and yet our outcomes lag the other industrialized nations of the world.
And you, Robert, one of the interesting ironies you point out in your book is that it takes an average of 17 years for an innovation to get into patient care. And you give several examples of this. You talk about, you know, despite enormous evidence supporting its use, it took forever for thermometers to be adopted, basic hand hygiene, you mentioned video visits. Are there any lessons for investors or entrepreneurs to understand in navigating this issue with physician culture to try to reform it, to try to innovate? Because it's challenging, right? Because a part of the culture itself is what makes it challenging to reform. In thinking about solutions, are there any cautionary approaches that can be taken to sort of take care of this headwind?
I talk about culture and the systemic issues as being these intertwined snakes, impossible to separate, because you're asking now more of a business school question than a medical school question.
Yep.
No, it's a very important differentiation, because in business school, the goal is not to improve health. The goal is an economically driven way to raise revenue and increase profitability. Now, if you think about that, given what I just mentioned, the best way to do that is actually to make healthcare more problematic. To benefit from the friction, not to diminish it. You know, it's interesting that I was reading yesterday an article from the medical literature about the use of long-acting, very expensive insulin in Medicare patients. And there's a lot of debate out there about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea, or exactly how to use it. And I'm not an expert around it. My background is reading about this stuff and reading the article yesterday.
Like Treceba? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. What they showed is that physicians who attended industry paid dinners prescribed 50% more compared to physicians who did not go, that the cost was increased by something like $171 per patient, and the outcomes were not in any way better. Now, others will probably disagree, and they may think that the reason that the added use was done was great science, but if that was the case, we should have been able to accomplish that through the more traditional research double-blind studies and not have it be dependent upon attending a dinner at a very fancy restaurant. And that's where the culture of medicine comes into play. I mean, what do doctors value? They value those things that make medical care more complex, as strange as that sounds. They value the multi-million dollar robots that have never been shown to improve outcomes, either in terms of life saved or complications avoided. Multi-million dollar proton beam accelerators. These are the tools that doctors love because it elevates status. It raises the physicians who use it up the hierarchy of medicine, as opposed to other tools that are less shiny, less Star Wars-like, the telemedicine being a great example, that lowers that esteem and respect created because it minimizes the importance of the physician office. So the answer is yes. And the lesson, unfortunately, on the business school side is if you really want to make a lot of money, sell products that are not particularly focused on lowering costs, but actually are focused on generating revenue. You know, I often tell people about the...
Build Fitbit. That physician culture, in other words, you know?
I tell people about the Fitbit. I don't know if you're wearing one or not, but,
Apple Watches.
Okay. Well, Apple Watch is different. But the Fitbit has two uses. Number one, it tells you how well you slept last night.
And it's a
gift.
And
number two, it tells you how far you went.
And number three, it's a gift. You buy it, so you give it to someone.
Well, exactly. It has nothing to do with those things. We know how well we slept last night. And if we didn't sleep well, the watch doesn't help you at all. As you say, you have an Apple Watch. I carry an Apple smartphone. It tells me how far I went. I don't have to use it. And yet it's the number one by a factor of 10 selling, or it and its similar products in the same genre. Number one, because it solves the problem called the December dilemma. You know, Christmas or Hanukkah is coming. You have someone you love a lot. You want to show them how much you care. And it's got to cost between $150 and $200. And for listeners who may be faculty from the last generation, it's the equivalent of inline skates, 50% of which never got used after December 26th.
That's so interesting.
But even think more beyond that. Think about all these monitors for heart rhythm. I mean, first of all, how many doctors want 100 rhythm strips sent to their office? Number two, ask yourself, what's the population we should be trying to use that device for? People who are older with atrial fibrillation, or people who don't yet know they have it? The people whose lives you can save are the ones who have the problem, who are older, but that's not who it's aimed for, because that entire industry is really not, it's not even shown to improve health. Theoretically, you can make some arguments that it might do so in a minor way. It's being done to sell products in the safest way possible. If you really wanted to combine medical school and business school, you would take wearable devices, you would load them with artificial intelligence, and every morning when you woke up, you would touch your device and it would say, you're fine today, or you're in trouble, call your doctor. Now, why would that be so powerful? Because now instead of seeing you with chronic disease or other problems on a routine basis, I'd say to you, come back and see me whenever your watch tells you you have a problem. Because I don't need to see you if you don't have a problem. And I need to see you sooner than every 3 or 4 months if you have a problem. So why doesn't Apple do it? Because of the medical legal risk. Because in every algorithm, there are errors. And doctors make them all the time. But when Apple were to make the error, now suddenly people are going to sue them. They're very, very deep pockets. You know, we already know with artificial intelligence that when it comes to some things like mammograms and certain x-rays of the chest, the data says that the algorithms are 10% better than doctors. And maybe they are today and maybe they're not, but if they're not today, they will be. So let's assume that mammograms is a great example. Doctors are about 70% consistent with each other in reading mammograms, about 70% accurate in being able to differentiate certain cancers from other disease of the breast that's not cancer. Let's assume machines are 90%. That's 20% better. Would people trust the machine rather than the doctor? Would they forgive the error in the machine rather than the error in the doctor? And the answer is no. And how do we know that? It's not just in medicine, it's called autonomous driving cars. 40,000 people die every year, and it rarely makes headlines outside of the local community newspaper. But if a machine, if an autonomous car crashes, all of a sudden it's front page headlines. This is part of the culture of medicine more broadly, not just the physician culture, but the global national culture and one we're going to have to get by if we want to make better decisions about safety, whether it's patient safety or driver safety.
You know, there's this concept, I think it's like the Planck principle, maybe Max Planck had said it, you know, where progress takes place not because people evolve, but because old people die out and new people come in. I was curious, do you think there will be an impact, or positive or negative, with these millennial and Gen X trainees coming in who don't know? Like, it was interesting. I was reading your book and I almost felt like you were keeping a historical record of this world before EMRs and before accountability, or, you know, before all these metrics. And it felt like I was looking into the past that seemed so foreign, and I don't even feel like I see vestiges of it in my own training. And now all I know is the EMR. I don't complain. I love it, weirdly. And I, maybe I'm a little different because I also, you know, think about these problems. But do you think there's an opportunity for millennials and Gen X trainees to have an impact on culture? And how do you think that might be ushered or championed?
So the quote you're referring to is this notion that the culture only ends when the people who embrace it die off, and that takes a long time. And that's an important notion because it has some truths inside of it. The first truth for physicians is that we learn our culture in medical school and residency, and we carry it with us across our entire career. And I talk about the white coat ceremony in the book, about the first day of medical school, and all the matriculating students come, their parents from the audience, they're called up by name to the stage, faculty member drapes the white coat over their shoulders. And the only exception is if the parents are physicians, and then they're allowed to drape the coat. And I point out again how absurd this sounds. I mean, in the audience is probably some families. Both parents work two jobs so their kid could study and get good grades and go to medical school. Maybe there's some farm workers who spent 14 hours a day bent over in the fields. Why shouldn't they have the same pride or more pride than the physicians who are able to make life easier for their offspring? This ceremony has nothing to do with the pride of the parents. This is the seeding of culture from parents to the faculty. And why can the parents who are doctors drape the coats? Because they already know the culture. So by definition, culture is of the past century today. As we said, the EMR, when we put the first one in, I think it was like 2003, 2004, we were at the front of the pack. EMRs have not been around for more than 20 years in practice. I mean, they've existed theoretically, but not in practice. The iPhone, that's 2007. We're only talking 13 years, 14 years. So what I would say about the generational shift is it's actually probably less about the generation that you're in than the time you have experienced this new world. So for the physicians who went to medical school more recently, they were there, as you say, with the EMR. They're used to having information, comprehensive information available to them. The idea of having a paper record is not just historical. It's something that wouldn't make any sense to them because it doesn't have all the information you need to take care of the patient. You know, I talk a lot about the number one way that doctors exchange information today is the fax machine. And there's a lot of people in my graduate school of business classes who've never seen a fax machine. This is the absurdity. It's an 1834 invention, and we're still using it. But as soon as you exchange information in a different way, you might not like what exists today, but you'd never go back to what happened in the past. This is the nature of culture that is sitting there. So the smartphone is a repository of information. I mean, think about medical school. What do we value in medical school? Rote memorization, arcane facts. That's what step one, this difficult exam, is all about. Now, why do we value that? Did you ever ask yourself, why is that so considered so important? Because before the smartphone existed, you'd need a 50-pound backpack to carry all the textbooks to have all the information. So you had to have it memorized in your brain. You couldn't look up the Krebs cycle without leaving the hospital, going to the library and finding the book. If you ever wanted to know the Krebs cycle for whatever reason, that's another story. But if you want to know it today, go on your smartphone. It takes 3 seconds. But what do we still value and test? Rote memorization of arcane facts. This is what was important in the last century, but we still do it today. That's the challenge that's there. So to the extent that the world is different, it's going to be the world that pushes and drives that shift. It's going to be easier for people who have more recently entered into the field, because for them, it's going to feel more natural. But don't forget that the culture of medicine that your parents allowed you, your teachers to give you, rather than whatever, however you were raised, is still inside of you. And as an example, I'll give you a great example, which is the value of intuition and personal experience. As doctors, we think that this is the highest value, our ability to do this deductive reasoning, this intuitive thinking, and every piece of data says no. The most important thing we could do is to follow evidence-based guidelines and checklists. Atul Gawande has shown this quite extensively. And I don't think the new generation is going to find that any more acceptable than the old generation. I think that that's not what's going to be valued. Will technology be easier? Yes. Will the EHR finally evolve and work? Yes. Will pieces that are there, the consumer mentality, I think that will be easier. The fact that now more than half of doctors work for someone else, for a hospital or for a medical group, this would have been unthought of in the past, and yet that's what the newest data shows. So the ease of change will happen more quickly. In the book, I talk about Kubler-Ross, the 5 stages of loss and grief. Right. And I point out, there are a lot of doctors today who are still in denial and anger. In fact, there are some of them who are really upset that I pulled back the veil and let people see both the heroic sides and some of the difficulties of the culture of medicine. But little is going to change to the direction they might like to see it happen. And then they'll bargain to keep a little of it. And then they'll get depressed when it doesn't happen. But acceptance is the end point. And answering your question, I think for the next generation, the new generation, acceptance will be easier to reach than it will be for the people who've been at it for a long time. But I don't think it'll be easy for any physicians. It's a flattening of the hierarchy that is happening. And I think if anything, it may get worse rather than getting better.
Huh. One of the curiosities I had, and this is going to be my second last question, is also as it pertains to the culture towards physician work ethic and work hours. In your book, you have this passage on how as a resident, you pulled virtually several all-nighters and reflect on how that can be so normalized in physician culture. I was curious if you had seen this recent World Health Organization study that came out, I think it was a week or two ago, that found that working more than 55 hours a week was associated with 35% increased risk of stroke, 17% increased risk of heart disease. Long hours were more dangerous and associated with more death than most other occupational hazards, including like risks to, from exposures to carcinogens. But recognizing the needs of medical training, did you, in case you encounter that study, did you have any reactions or reflections on that? And I think this has been, I feel like 100 years from now, residency and fellowship will not look anything like it does right now in the way it's set up. But I feel like as somebody who has been especially surgically trained, maybe you might have a more nuanced perspective on that.
I read the study about that. And it's actually something I've spoken about, not in terms of I didn't have the 55 hours per se from the study itself, but I've often asked people who are not in medicine, how many professions would celebrate that residents only work 80 hours a week.
It's crazy. And it's not 80 hours. It's like 320 hours a month, which is a very different thing. It's a very, very different thing because you can work higher some hours and lower some other ones.
Exactly. It's not 80 hours a week. You just got to drive to the hospital and drive back. Yeah. So now you've added 10 more, so it's 90. And by the way, if you're going to be a surgical resident, you got to read for the cases. And by the way, you have to prepare for your annual every year examination. Yeah, it's well over 100, and we celebrate that. And the fact that it was only done because of the impact on patients rather than on doctors. So the answer is yes. Becoming a physician is dangerous to your health. Taking care of people with COVID is dangerous to your health. And this is, to some extent, I would say, the heroic side. And I don't know exactly how much of it we want to give up. Not because, well, if I did it, you should, or not because it somehow is something that needs to happen, and never admit that you're weak and never admit that you're hurting or need help or whatever. No. It's that it may just be something that's needed to master all the pieces that are there in a time frame that works. You can expand residency to 10 years, but already people are coming out of medical school with $200,000 debt. They're often had a couple of years in between. They're 30, 32, and now you're going to be 42. And at some point you want to have kids. And we can go on and on about the problems. But I also think that we shouldn't lose the positive sides. And that's where there's a difference between working 80 hours a week, doing a lot of menial tasks and spending the time in front of computers and spending that time engaged in the mission and the purpose of medicine. And for people who don't quite agree yet, I'll offer, as I said, I fixed children with cleft lip and cleft palate. I've gone quite a number of trips around the world, volunteered for them. I've never seen anyone come back not energized. You go to South or Central America, you fix kids with cleft lip and cleft palate 12, 14, 16 hours a day, day in, day out. It's extremely hot. There's no air conditioning. You're eating rice and beans. You have intestinal diarrhea. Everything couldn't be worse. You come back full of energy. I talk at Uncaring about the doctor who volunteered to go to Liberia, who had to have IVs going into his arm because in the protective suit against Ebola that he was treating, he was going to lose so much liquid that he would have passed out from dehydration. And yet he came back glowing. I'm not saying that's what everyone should do. And I'm being very, very respectful of the challenges people have, the economics, the needs in their life. But I do think that we have robbed ourselves of a little bit of the mission and purpose. And some of that is being heroic. And I think that we should celebrate that, but build on it. We should ask ourselves, how can we reduce that without harming patients? Because any solution that's either going to make care more unaffordable or make care difficult to access, it's going to be a non-starter. We may think it's the right thing for us, but the rest of the world isn't going to care about that. But how do we put together teams? How do we use technology in a way to improve health? How do we find ways to come together so that rather than every night at 5 p.m. closing our offices and telling patients, go to the emergency room, one of 10 of us is on call that night. Next day off or the day before off, however we're going to structure it. And we can provide care in a better way. And it may not be as exciting. It may not be as glamorous as some of the other things that we do, but I think it can be just as rewarding if we're successful at it. And that's going to require courage, and that's going to require leadership.
That's really insightful. I appreciate that. Well, for my very last question, Robert, we have a little tradition of asking our guests, we ask them if there's anything they came across recently that they might recommend for the audience. It could be a book, an article, a TV show, a song, a movie, another podcast, your podcast, anything. Is there something you might have come across recently you found compelling or interesting that you might recommend?
Well, I'm hoping that people will listen to the last episode of my Fixing Healthcare podcast. It's one that's going to be made available a week from, no, actually this coming Sunday night, a week from Sunday night. I'll be available Sunday night on through any of the Apple or Spotify or any other places you'd like to go.
So June 13th, just because this episode will come out in a week. So
I'm
June
13th. Sorry.
No worries.
Yeah. Come out on June 13th. It'll be coming out on Sunday night, June 13th, but it'll be available for people who want to subscribe to the monthly musings that I publish every month. That will come out on Tuesday. There'll be links to it. And it summarizes season 5 that we just finished on Fixing Healthcare. And we've had amazing, amazing guests. And they focused on this issue of culture of medicine. We've confronted racism, sexism, physician resistance to information technology, difficulty of talking about end-of-life decisions and death. We've looked at primary care and how it is undervalued. We've been able to scan the entire horizon. And in this show, the 9th show of the season, the co-host, Jeremy Corr, interviews me and asks me to comment upon a insight or a set of insights into the physician culture. And I think, I'm hoping that listeners and to the podcast will come away with that, at least stimulated to think. And I want to encourage people to go to the website, robertpearlmd.com, be able to get the information, to read the book, and then engage in the conversation. I'm a big believer that change doesn't happen until the participants become diverse and numerous, that they have to be able to engage in open and honest ways, that the social media trend of only following the people you agree with and someone else following the ones that they agree with never crisscross. And I'm hoping that this book on caring, how the culture of medicine kills doctors and patients, will be a step forward. And I'd invite your viewers and your listeners who read the book, if they have thoughts, if they have insights, please send them to me so that I can learn. I offer a starting point in the book, but ultimately together we're going to have to evolve this. And as I often say at the end of my podcast, make American medicine once again the best in the world.
Oh, that's amazing. And I cannot stress enough how incredible your monthly musings are. I've been reading them for 4 years. They're amazing and they're so accessible. Well, Robert, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me today. I had such a lovely time. I really, really appreciate it.
I appreciate it very much. And I appreciate your listening audience joining in to the debate, to the conversation, and helping to move both the system of medicine and its culture. Don't lose the good parts, but don't be afraid to evolve the ones that are more problematic. Thank you so much.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcast or whichever podcast platform you use. And if there's something you found you really liked or didn't like, or would like to make a suggestion, feel free to reach out by email at info@tdio.org.